Well, hello, and welcome back to From the Center, the podcast of the Center for Western Studies. I'm John Hodges, the director here, and I am very pleased to be offering you something special today. I would like to be able to tell you a little bit about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was perhaps the greatest of the dissident opponents of the old Soviet Union. He was a Russian and born in 1918. He lived through the Second World War, and at the end of the war, he was arrested for criticisms that he made of Premier Joseph Stalin. Now, Stalin sent him to the Siberian Gulag for 8 years of hard labor for that. When he was released in 1953, he was still forced to remain in Eastern Russia in a kind of exile within his own country. His first books were written in the 1960s, after he was released from that exile, and by the end of the 60s, the Soviets cracked down on him again. And his books had to be written and kept secret, smuggled out of the country to be published in the West. Those books included One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, Cancer Ward, and even the massive three-volume Gulag Archipelago. In 1970, he was nominated and won the Nobel Prize in Literature, quote, for the ethical force with which he has pursued the indispensable traditions of Russian literature, end quote. He was not allowed to leave the country to receive it. In 1974, he was exiled from Russia on the charge of treason, and he moved to the United States, where he lived until the Iron Curtain fell, and in 1994, he returned to his native Russia and died there of heart attack in 2008. He was 89 years old. Now, when he won this Nobel Prize, he couldn't attend in person because of the limitations of the Soviet regime. But he decided to accept the Nobel Prize in absentia. And he wrote out a speech, an acceptance speech, but it was a speech that was never given. I'd like to read that to you now, that very Nobel Prize speech from 1970. Just as that puzzled savage who has picked up a strange cast up from the ocean, something unearthed from the sands, or an object fallen from the sky, intricate in curves, it gleams first dully and then with a bright thrust of light, just as he turns it this way and that, turns it over, trying to discover what to do with it, trying to discover some mundane function within his own grasp, never dreaming of its higher function, so also we, holding art in our hands, confidently consider ourselves to be its masters. Boldly we direct it, we renew, reform, manifest it, we sell it for money, use it to please those in power, turn it to one moment for amusement, write down, turn it at one moment for amusement, right down to popular songs and nightclubs, and at another moment, grabbing the nearest weapon, cordial or cork, for the passing needs of politics and for narrow-minded social ends. But art is not defiled by our efforts, neither does it thereby depart from its true nature, but on each occasion and in each application, it gives to us a part of its secret inner light. But shall we ever grasp the whole of that light? Who will dare to say that he has defined art, enumerated all its facets? Perhaps once upon a time someone understood and told us, but we could not remain satisfied with that for long. We listened and neglected and threw it out there and then, hurrying as always to exchange even the very best, if only for something new. And when we are told again the old truth, we shall not even remember that we once possessed it. One artist sees himself as the creator of an independent spiritual world. He hoists on his shoulders the task of creating this world, of peopling it, and of bearing the all-embracing responsibility for it, but he crumples beneath it, for a mortal genius is not capable of bearing such a burden. just as man in general, having declared himself the center of existence, has not succeeded in creating a balanced spiritual system. And if misfortune overtakes him, he casts the blame upon the age-long disharmony of the world, upon the complexity of today's ruptured soul, or upon the stupidity of the public. Another artist, recognizing a higher power above, gladly works as a humble apprentice beneath God's heaven. Then, however, his responsibility for everything that is written or drawn for the souls which perceive his work is more exacting than ever. But in return, it is not he who has created this world, not he who has directed it. There is no doubt as to its foundations. The artist has merely to be more keenly aware than others of the harmony of the world, of the beauty and ugliness of the human contribution to it, and to communicate this acutely to his fellow men. And in misfortune, and even at the depths of existence, in destitution, in prison, in sickness, his sense of stable harmony never deserts him. But all the irrationality of art, its dazzling turns, its unpredictable discoveries, its shattering influence on human beings, they are too full of magic to be exhausted by this artist's view of the world, by his artistic conception, or by the work of his unworthy fingers. Archaeologists have not discovered stages of human existence so early that they were without art. Right back in the early morning twilights of mankind, we received it from hands which we were too slow to discern. And we were too slow to ask, for what purpose have we been given this gift? What are we to do with it? And they were mistaken, and will always be mistaken, who prophesy that art will disintegrate, that it will outlive its forms and die. It is we who shall die. Art will remain. And shall we comprehend, even on the day of our destruction, all its facets and all its possibilities? Not everything assumes a name. Some things lead beyond words. Art inflames even a frozen, darkened soul to a high spiritual experience. Through art, we are sometimes visited, dimly, briefly, by revelations such as cannot be produced by rational thinking. Like that little looking glass from the fairy tales, look into it and you will see not yourself, but for one second the inaccessible whither no man can ride, no man fly. And only the soul gives a groan. One day, Dostoevsky threw out the enigmatic remark, "Beauty will save the world." What sort of statement is that? For a long time, I considered it mere words. How could it be possible? When, in bloodthirsty history, did beauty ever save anyone from anything? Ennobled, uplifted, yes, but whom has it saved? There is, however, a certain peculiarity in the essence of beauty, a peculiarity in the status of art. Namely, the convincingness of a true work of art is completely irrefutable, and it forces even an opposing heart to surrender. It is possible to compose an outwardly smooth and elegant political speech, a headstrong article, a social program, or a philosophical system on the basis of both a mistake and a lie. What is hidden, what distorted, will not immediately become obvious. Then a contradictory speech, article, program, a differently constructed philosophy rallies in opposition, and all just as elegant and smooth, and once again it works, which is why such things are both trusted and mistrusted. In vain to reiterate what does not reach the heart. But a work of art bears within itself its own verification. Conceptions which are devised or stretched do not stand being portrayed in images. They all come crashing down, appear sickly and pale, convince no one. But those works of art which have scooped up the truth and presented it to us as a living force, they take hold of us, compel us, and nobody ever, not even in ages to come, will appear to refute them. So perhaps that ancient trinity of truth, goodness, and beauty is not simply an empty, faded formula as we thought in the days of our self-confident, materialistic youth. If the tops of these three trees converge, as the scholars maintained, but the two blatant, two direct stems of truth and goodness are crushed, cut down, not allowed through, then perhaps the fantastic, unpredictable, unexpected stems of beauty will push through and soar to that very same place, and in doing so, will fulfill the work of all three. In that case, Dostoevsky's remark, "beauty will save the world," was not a careless phrase, but a prophecy. After all, he was granted to see much, a man of fantastic illumination. And in that case, art, literature, might really be able to help the world today. It is the small insight which over the years I have succeeded in gaining into this matter that I shall attempt to lay before you here today. In order to mount this platform from which the Nobel lecture is read, a platform offered to far from every writer and only once in a lifetime, I have climbed not three or four makeshift steps, but hundreds and even thousands of them, unyielding, precipitous, frozen steps, leading out of the darkness and cold where it was my fate to survive, while others, perhaps with a greater gift and stronger than I, have perished. Of them, I myself met but a few on the archipelago of Gulag, shattered into its fractionary multitude of islands, and beneath the millstone of shadowing and mistrust, I did not talk to them all. Of some I only heard. Of others, still, I only guessed. Those who fell into that abyss, already bearing a literary name, are at least known, but how many were never recognized, never once mentioned in public, and virtually no one managed to return. A whole national literature remained there, cast into oblivion, not only without a grave, but without even underclothes, naked, with a number tagged on its toe. Russian literature did not cease for a moment, but from the outside it appeared a wasteland. Where a peaceful forest could have grown, there remained, after all the felling, two or three trees overlooked by chance. And as I stand here today, accompanied by the shadows of the fallen, with bowed head allowing others who were worthy before to pass ahead of me to this place, as I stand here, how am I to define and to express what they would have wished to say? This obligation has long weighed upon us, and we have understood it. In the words of Vladimir Solovyev, "Even in chains, we ourselves must complete that circle which the gods have mapped out for us." Frequently in painful camp meetings in a column of prisoners, when chains of lanterns pierced the gloom of the evening forests, there would well up inside us the words that we should like to cry out to the whole world, if the whole world could hear one of us. Then it seemed so clear what our successful ambassador would say and how the world would immediately respond with its comment. Our horizon embraced quite distinctly both physical things and spiritual movement, and it saw no lopsidedness in the indivisible world. These ideas did not come from books, neither were they imported for the sake of coherence. They were formed in conversations with people now dead, in prison cells and by forest fires. They were tested against that life. They grew out of that existence. When at last the outer pressure grew a little weaker, my and our horizon broadened, and gradually, albeit through a minute chink, we saw and knew, quote, the whole world. And to our amazement, the whole world was not at all as we had expected, as we had hoped. That is to say, a world living not by that, a world leading not there, a world which could exclaim at the sight of a muddy swamp, "What a delightful little puddle!" At concrete neck stocks, "What an exquisite necklace!" But instead, a world where some weep inconsolate tears and others dance to a light-hearted musical. How could this happen? Why this yawning gap? Were we insensitive? Was the world insensitive? Or is it due to language differences? Why is it that people are not able to hear each other's every distinct utterance? Words cease to sound and run away like water, without taste, color, smell, without trace. As I have come to understand this, so through the years has changed and changed again the structure, content, and tone of my potential speech, the speech I give today. And it has little in common with its original plan conceived on frosty camp evenings. From time immemorial, man has been made in such a way that his vision of the world, so long as it has not been instilled under hypnosis, his motivations and scales of value, his actions and intentions are determined by his personal and group experience of life. As the Russian saying goes, quote, "Do not believe your brother, believe your own crooked eye," end quote. And that is the most sound basis for an understanding of the world around us and of human conduct in it. And during the long epochs when our world lay spread out in mystery and wilderness, before it became encroached by common lines of communication, before it was transformed into a single convulsively pulsating lump, men, relying on experience, ruled without mishap within their limited areas, within their communities, within their societies, and finally on their national territories. At that time, it was possible for individual human beings to perceive and accept a general scale of values, to distinguish between what is considered normal, what incredible, what is cruel, and what lies beyond the boundaries of wickedness, what is honesty and what is deceit. And although the scattered people led extremely different lives, and their social values were often strikingly at odds, just as their system of weights and measures did not agree, still, these discrepancies surprised only occasional travelers, were reported in journals under the name of wonders, and bore no danger to mankind which was not yet won. But now, during the past few decades, imperceptibly, suddenly, mankind has become one, hopefully one and dangerously one, so that the concussions and inflammations of one of its parts are almost instantaneously passed on to others, sometimes lacking in any kind of necessary immunity. Mankind has become one, but not steadfastly one as communities or even nations used to be, not united through years of mutual experience, neither through possession of a single eye, affectionately called crooked, nor yet through a common native language, but surpassing all barriers through international broadcasting and print. An avalanche of events descends upon us. In 1 minute, half the world hears of their splash. But the yardstick by which to measure these events and to evaluate them in accordance with the laws of unfamiliar parts of the world, this is not and cannot be conveyed via sound waves and in newspaper columns, for these yardsticks were matured and assimilated over too many years of too specific conditions in individual countries and societies. They cannot be exchanged in midair. In the various parts of the world, men apply their own hard-earned values to events, and they judge stubbornly, confidently, only according to their own scales of values and never according to any others. And if there are not many such different scales of values in the world, there are at least several. One for evaluating events near at hand, another for events far away, Aging societies possess one, young societies another, unsuccessful people one, successful people another. The divergent scales of values scream in discordance. They dazzle and daze us. And in order that it might not be painful, we steer clear of all other values, as though from insanity, as though from illusion, and we confidently judge the whole world according to our own home values, which is why we take for the greater, more painful, and less bearable disaster, not that which is in fact greater, more painful, and less bearable, but that which lies closest to us. Everything which is further away, which does not threaten this very day to invade our threshold, with all its groans, its stifled cries, its destroyed lives, even if it involves millions of victims, this we consider on the whole to be perfectly bearable and of tolerable proportions. In one part of the world, not so long ago, under persecutions not inferior to those of the ancient Romans, hundreds of thousands of silent Christians gave up their lives for their belief in God. In the other hemisphere, a certain madman, and no doubt he is not alone, speeds across the ocean to deliver us from religion, which, with a thrust of steel into the high priest, he has calculated for each and every one of us according to his personal scale of values. That which from a distance, according to one scale of values, appears as enviable and flourishing freedom at close quarters and according to other values, is felt to be infuriating constraint calling for buses to be overthrown. That which in one part of the world might represent a dream of incredible prosperity, in another has the exasperating effect of wild exploitation demanding immediate strike. There are different scales of values for natural catastrophes. A flood craving 200,000 lives seems less significant than our local accident. There are different scales of values for personal insults. Sometimes even an ironic smile or a dismissive gesture is humiliating, while for others, cruel beatings are forgiven as an unfortunate joke. There are different scales of values for punishment and wickedness. According to one, a month's arrest, banishment to the country, or an isolation cell where one is fed on white rolls and milk, shatters the imagination and fills the newspaper columns with rage. Shatters the imagination. Let me read all that again. There are different scales of values for punishment and wickedness. According to one, a month's arrest, banishment to the country, or an isolation cell where one is fed on white rolls and milk, shatters the imagination and fills the newspaper columns with rage. Shatters the imagination and fills the newspaper columns with rage. While according to another, prison sentences of 25 years, isolation cells where the walls are covered with ice and the prisoners stripped to their underclothes, lunatic asylums for the sane, and countless unreasonable people who, for some reason, will keep running away. Shot on the frontiers, all this is common and accepted. While the mind is especially at peace concerning that exotic part of the world about which we know virtually nothing, from which we do not even receive news or events, but only the trivial, out-of-date guesses of a few correspondents. Yet we cannot reproach human vision for this duality, for this dumbfounded incomprehension of another man's distant grief. Man is just made that way. But for the whole of mankind, compressed into a single lump, such mutual incomprehension presents the threat of imminent and violent destruction. One world, one mankind, cannot exist on the face of six, four, or even two scales of value. One world, one mankind cannot exist in the face of six, four, or even two scales of value. We will be torn apart by this disparity of rhythm, this disparity of vibrations. A man with two hearts is not for this world, neither shall we be able to live side by side on one earth. But who will coordinate these value scales, and how? Who will create for mankind one system of interpretation, valid for good evil, valid for good and evil deeds, for the unbearable and the bearable, as they are differentiated today? Who will make clear to mankind what is really heavy and intolerable, and what only grazes the skin locally? Who will direct the anger to that which is most terrible and not to that which is nearer? Who might succeed in transferring such an understanding beyond the limits of his own human experience? Who might succeed in impressing upon a bigoted, stubborn human creature the distant joy and grief of others, an understanding of dimensions and deceptions which he himself has never experienced? Propaganda, constraint, scientific proof, all are useless. But fortunately, there does exist such a means in our world. That means is art. That means is literature. They can perform a miracle. They can overcome man's detrimental peculiarity of learning only from personal experience, so that the experience of other people passes by in vain. From man to man, as he completes his brief spell on earth, art transfers the whole weight of an unfamiliar lifelong experience with all its burdens, its colors, its sap of life. It recreates in the flesh an unknown experience and allows us to possess it as our own. And even more, much more than that, both countries and whole continents repeat each other's mistakes with time lapses which can account to centuries. Then one would think it would all be so obvious. But no, that which some nations have already experienced, considered, and rejected is suddenly discovered by others to be the latest word. And here again, the only substitute for an experience we ourselves have never lived through is art, literature. They possess a wonderful ability beyond distinctions of language, custom, social structure. They can convey the life experience of one whole nation to another. To an inexperienced nation, they can convey a harsh rational To an inexperienced nation, they can convey a harsh national trial lasting many decades, at best sparing an entire nation from a superfluous or mistaken or even disastrous course, thereby curtailing the meanderings of human history. It is this great and noble property of art that I urgently recall to you today from the Nobel Tribune. And literature conveys irrefutable condensed experience in yet another invaluable direction, namely from generation to generation. Thus it becomes the living memory of the nation. Thus it preserves and kindles within itself the flame of her spent history in a form which is safe from defamation and slander. In this way, literature, together with language, protects the soul of the nation. In recent times, it's been fashionable to talk of the leveling of nations, of the disappearance of different races in the melting pot of contemporary civilization. I do not agree with this opinion, but its discussion remains another question. Here, it is merely fitting to say that the disappearance of nations would have impoverished us no less than if all men had become alike, with one personality and one face. Nations are the wealth of mankind, its collective personalities. The very least of them wears its own special colors and bears within itself a special facet of divine intention. But woe to that nation whose literature is disturbed by the intervention of power, because that is not just a violation against freedom of print. It is the closing down of the heart of the nation, a slashing to pieces of its memory. The nation ceases to be mindful of itself. It is deprived of its spiritual unity and despite a supposedly common language, compatriots suddenly cease to understand one another. Silent generations grow old and die without ever having talked about themselves, either to each other or to their descendants. When writers such as Akhmatova and Zamjatin, interred alive throughout their lives, are condemned to create in silence until they die, never hearing the echo of their written words, then that is not only their personal tragedy, but a sorrow to the whole nation, a danger to the whole nation. In some cases, moreover, when, as a result of such silence, the whole of history ceases to be understood in its entirety, it is a danger to the whole of mankind. At various times and in various countries, there have arisen heated, angry, and exquisite debates as to whether art and the artist should be free to live for themselves, or whether they should be forever mindful of their duty towards society and serve it, albeit in an unprejudiced way. For me, there is no dilemma, but I shall refrain from raising once again the train of arguments. One of the most brilliant addresses on the subject was actually Albert Camus' Nobel speech, and I would happily subscribe to its conclusions. Indeed, Russian literature has, for several decades, manifested an inclination not to become too lost in contemplation of itself, not to flutter about too frivolously. I am not ashamed to continue this tradition in the best of my ability. Russian literature has long been familiar with the notions that a writer can do much within his society and that it is his duty to do so. Let us not violate the right of the artist to express exclusively his own experiences and introspections, disregarding everything that happens in the world beyond. Let us not demand of the artist, but reproach, beg, urge, and entice him that we may be allowed to do. After all, only in part does he himself develop his talent. The greater part of it is blown into him at birth as a finished product, and the gift of talent imposes responsibility on his free will. Let us assume that the artist does not owe anybody anything. Nevertheless, it is painful to see how, by retiring into his man... Nevertheless, it is painful to see how, by retiring into his self-made worlds or the spaces of his subjective whims, he can surrender the real world into the hands of men who are mercenary, if not worthless, if not insane. Our 20th century has proved to be more cruel than preceding centuries, and the first 50 years have not erased all its horrors. Our world is rent asunder by those same old cave-age emotions of greed, envy, lack of control, mutual hostility, which have picked up in passing respectable pseudonyms like class struggle, racial conflict, struggle of the masses, trade union disputes. The primeval refusal to accept a compromise has been turned into a theoretical principle and is considered the virtue of orthodoxy. It demands millions of sacrifices in ceaseless civil wars. It drums into our souls that it drums into our souls that there is no such thing as unchanging universal concepts of goodness and justice, that they are all fluctuating and inconsistent, that they are all fluctuating and inconstant. Therefore, the rule, always do what's most profitable to your party. Any professional group no sooner sees a convenient opportunity to break off a piece, even if it be unearned, of... Let me go back. The primeval refusal to accept a compromise has been turned into a theoretical principle, that is, considered the virtue of orthodoxy. It demands millions of sacrifices in ceaseless civil wars. It drums into our souls that there is no such thing as unchanging universal concepts of goodness and justice, that they are all fluctuating and inconstant. Therefore, the rule, always do what's most profitable to your party. Any professional group no sooner sees a convenient opportunity to break off a piece, even if it be unearned, even if it be superfluous, then it breaks it off there and then, and no matter if the whole society comes tumbling down. As seen from the outside, the amplitude of the tossings of Western society is approaching that point beyond which the system becomes metastable and must fall. Violence, less and less embarrassed by the limits imposed by centuries of lawfulness, is brazenly and victoriously striding across the whole world, unconcerned that its infertility has been demonstrated and proved many times in history. What is more, it is not simply crude power that triumphs abroad, but its exultant justification. The world is being inundated by the brazen conviction that power can do anything, justice nothing. Dostoevsky's Devils, apparently a provincial nightmare fantasy of the last century, are crawling across the whole world in front of our very eyes, infesting countries where they could not have been dreamed of. Infesting countries where they could not even have been dreamed of, and by means of the hijackings, kidnappings, explosions, and fires of recent years, they are announcing their determination to shake and destroy civilization. And they may well succeed. The young, at an age when they have not yet any experience other than sexual, when they do not yet have years of personal suffering and personal understanding behind them, are jubilantly repeating our depraved Russian blunders of the 19th century under the impression that they are discovering something new. They acclaim the last wretched degradation on the part of the Chinese Red Guards as a joyous example. In shallow lack of understanding of the age-old essence of mankind, in the naive confidence of inexperienced hearts, they cry, "Let us drive away those cruel, greedy oppressors, governments, and the new ones, we, having laid aside grenades and rifles, will be just and understanding." Far from it. But of those who have lived more and understand, those who could oppose these young, many do not dare oppose. They even suck up anything not to appear, quote, conservative. Another Russian phenomenon of the 19th century, which Dostoevsky called slavery to progressive quirks. The spirit of Munich has by no means retreated into the past. It was not merely a brief episode. I even venture to say that the spirit of Munich prevails in the 20th century. The timid, civilized world has found nothing with which to oppose the onslaught of a sudden revival of barefaced barbarity, other than concessions and smiles. The spirit of Munich is a sickness of the will of successful people. It is the daily condition of those who have given themselves up to the thirst after prosperity at any price, to material well-being as the chief goal of earthly existence. Such people, and there are many in today's world, elect passivity and retreat just so as their accustomed life might drag on a bit longer, just so as not to step over the threshold of hardship today. And tomorrow, you'll see, it will all be all right. But it will never be all right. The price of cowardice will only be evil. We shall reap courage and victory only when we dare to make sacrifices. And on top of this, we are threatened by destruction in the fact that the physically compressed, strained world is not allowed to blend spiritually. The molecules of knowledge and sympathy are not allowed to jump over from one half to the other. This presents a rampant danger, the suppression of information between the parts of the planet. Contemporary science knows that suppression of information leads to entropy and total destruction. Suppression of information renders international signatures and agreements illusory. Within a muffled zone, it costs nothing to reinterpret any agreement, even simpler, to forget it, as though it had never really existed. Orwell understood this supremely. A muffled zone is, as it were, populated not by inhabitants of the Earth, but by an expeditionary corps from Mars. The people know nothing intelligent about the rest of Earth and are prepared to go and trample it down in the holy conviction that they have come as liberators. A quarter of a century ago, in the great hopes of mankind, the United Nations Organization was born. Alas, in an immoral world, this too grew up to be immoral. It is not a United Nations organization, but a United Governments organization where all governments stand equal, those which are freely elected, those imposed forcibly, and those which have seized power with weapons. Relying on the mercenary partiality of the majority, UNO jealously guards the freedom of some nations and neglects the freedom of others. As a result of an obedient vote, it declined to undertake the investigation of private appeals, the groans, screams, and beseechings of humble individual plain people, not large enough to catch for such a great organization. UNO made no effort to make the Declaration of Human Rights, its best document in the 25 years, into an obligatory condition of membership, confronting the governments. Thus it betrayed those humble people into the will of the governments which they had not chosen. It would seem that the appearance of the contemporary world rests solely in the hands of the scientists. All mankind's technical steps are determined by them. It would seem that it is precisely on the international goodwill of scientists and not of politicians that the direction of the world should depend. All the more so since the example of the few shows how much could be achieved when they are all to pull together. But no, scientists have not manifested any clear attempt to become an important, independently active force of mankind. They spend entire congresses in renouncing the sufferings of others. Better to stay safely within the precincts of science. That same spirit of Munich has spread above them its enfeebling wings. What, then, is the place and role of the writer in this cruel, dynamic, split world on the brink of its 10 destructions? After all, we have nothing to do with letting off rockets. We do not even push the lowliest of handcarts. We are quite scorned by those who respect only material power. It is not natural for us, too, to step back, to lose faith in the steadfastness of goodness, in the indivisibility of truth, and to just impart to the world our bitter, detached observations, how mankind has become hopelessly corrupt, how men have degenerated, and how difficult it is for the few beautiful and refined souls to live amongst them. But we have not even recourse to this flight. Anyone who has once taken up the word can never again evade it. A writer is not the detached judge of his compatriots and contemporaries. He is an accomplice to all the evil committed in his native land or by his countrymen. And if the tanks of his fatherland have flooded the asphalt of a foreign capital with blood, then the brown spots have slapped against the face of the writer forever. And if one fatal night they suffocated his sleeping, trusting friend, then the palms of the writer bear the bruises from that rope. And if his young fellow citizens breezily declare the superiority of depravity over honest work, if they give themselves over to drugs or seize hostages, then their stink mingles with the breath of the writer. Shall we have the temerity to declare that we are not responsible for the sores of the present-day world? However, I am cheered by a vital awareness of world literature as of a single huge heart beating out the cares and troubles of our world, albeit presented and perceived differently in each of its corners. Apart from age-old national literatures, there existed, even in past ages, the conception of world literature as an anthology skirting the heights of the national literatures, and as the sum total of mutual literary influences. But there occurred a lapse in time. Readers and writers became acquainted with writers of other tongues only after a time lapse, sometimes lasting centuries, so that mutual influences were also delayed, and the anthology of national literary heights was revealed only in the eyes of descendants, not in contemporaries. But today, between the writers of one country and the writers and readers of another, there is a reciprocity, if not instantaneous, then almost so. I experience this myself. Those of my books, which, alas, have not been printed in my own country, have found a responsive worldwide audience, despite hurried and often bad translations. Such distinguished Western writers as Heinrich Böll have undertaken critical analyses of them. All these last years, when my work and freedom have not come crashing down, when, contrary to the laws of gravity, they have hung suspended as though in air, as though on nothing, on the invisible dumb tension of a sympathetic public membrane, then it was with grateful warmth and quite unexpectedly for myself that I learned of the further support of the International Brotherhood of Writers. On my 50th birthday, I was astonished to receive congratulations from well-known Western writers. No pressure on me came to pass by unnoticed. During my dangerous weeks of exclusion from the Writers' Union, the wall of defense advanced by the world's prominent writers protected me from worse persecutions. And Norwegian writers and artists hospitably prepared a roof for me in the event of my threatened exile being put into effect. Finally, even the advancement of my name for the Nobel Prize was raised not in the country where I live and write, but by François Mauriac and his colleagues, and later still, entire national writers' unions have expressed their support for me. Thus, I have understood and felt that world literature is no longer an abstract anthology, nor a generalization invented by literary historians. It is rather a certain common body and a common spirit, a living, heartfelt unity, reflecting the growing unity of mankind. State frontiers still turn crimson, heated by electric wire and bursts of machine fire. And various ministries of internal affairs still think that literature, too, is an internal affair falling under their jurisdiction. Newspaper headlines still display no right to interfere in our internal affairs, whereas there are no internal affairs left on our crowded earth. And mankind's sole salvation lies in everyone making everything his business, in the people of the East being vitally concerned with what is thought in the West, the people in the West vitally concerned with what goes on in the East, and literature as one of the most sensitive, responsive instruments possessed by the human creature, has been one of the first to adopt, to assimilate, to catch hold of this feeling of growing unity of mankind. And so I turn with confidence to the world literature of today, to hundreds of friends whom I have never met in the flesh and whom I may never see. Friends, let us try to help if we are worth anything at all. Who from time immemorial has constituted the uniting, not the dividing, strength in your countries, lacerated by discordant parties, movements, castes, and groups? There in its essence is the position of writers, expressors of their native language, the chief binding force of the nation, of the very earth its people occupy, and at best of its national spirit. I believe that world literature has in it its power to help mankind in these troubled hours, to see itself as it really is, notwithstanding the indoctrinations of prejudiced people and parties. World literature has in its power to convey condensed experience from one land to another, so that we might cease to be split and dazzled, that the different scales of values might be made to agree, and one nation learn correctly and concisely the true history of another, with such strength of recognition and painful awareness as it had itself experienced the same, and thus might it be spared from repeating the same cruel mistakes. And perhaps, under such conditions, we artists will be able to cultivate within ourselves a field of vision to embrace the whole world, in the center, observing, like any other human being, that which lies nearby. At the edges, we shall begin to draw in that which is happening in the rest of the world, and we shall correlate and we shall observe world propositions. And who, if not writers, are to pass judgment, not only on their unsuccessful governments? In some states, this is the easiest way to earn one's bread, the occupation of any man who is not lazy, but also on the people themselves, in their cowardly humiliation or self-satisfied weakness. Who is to pass judgment on the lightweight sprints of youth and on the young pirates brandishing their knives? We shall be told, what can literature possibly do against the ruthless onslaught of open violence? But let us not forget that violence does not live alone and is not capable of living alone. It is necessarily interwoven with falsehood. Between them lies the most intimate and deepest of our natural bonds. Violence finds its only refuge in falsehood. Falsehood its only support in violence. Any man who has once acclaimed violence as his method must inexorably choose falsehood as his principle. At its birth, violence acts openly and even with pride. No sooner does it become strong, firmly established, than it senses the rarefaction of the air around it, and it cannot continue to exist without descending into a fog of lies, clothing them in sweet talk. It does not always, not necessarily, openly throttle the throat. More often it demands from its subjects only an oath of allegiance to falsehood, only complicity in falsehood. And the simple step of a simple, courageous man is not to partake in falsehood, not to support false actions. Let that enter the world. Let it even reign in the world, but not with my help. But writers and artists can achieve more. They can conquer falsehood. In the struggle with falsehood, art always did win, and it always does win. Openly, irrefutably for everyone. Falsehood can hold out against much in this world, but not against art. And no sooner will falsehood be dispersed than the nakedness of violence will be revealed in all of its ugliness, and violence, decrepit, will fall. That is why, my friends, I believe that we are able to help the world in its white-hot hour, not by making the excuse of possessing no weapons, and not by giving ourselves over to a frivolous life, but by going to war. proverbs about truth are well-loved in Russian. They give steady and sometimes striking expression to the not inconsiderable harsh national experience. One word of truth shall outweigh the whole world. And it is here on an imaginary fantasy, a breach of the principle of the conservation of mass and energy, that I base both my own activity and my appeal to the writers of the whole world. You've been listening to Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 1970 Nobel Prize speech, a speech that was never given to the Nobel Committee in 1970 because he was not allowed to leave the country. He was not allowed to leave his homeland of Russia. Later in 1974, as I said, he was exiled from his country for treason. He was charged with treason, and rather than executing him or sending him back to the Gulag, he was by this time too popular and well-known a writer in the world. They exiled him, and he went from Russia and lived many years in the United States, where he certainly continued to condemn the Soviet Union and its oppressions. But he was also a critic of the materialism that he found in the United States. So he speaks from a more profound position than either side in the Cold War that he lived through. If you'd like to hear more about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, I recommend starting with the novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Talks about life in the Gulag. And then beyond that, I think everybody ought to know the Gulag Archipelago. He wrote three volumes, then later on condensed those three volumes into one, and that one, I think, covers the material well. It's okay to read the condensed version. You'll still get a sense of what he's talking about. But then Cancer Ward and The Oak and the Calf both need to be read as well. So I leave him with you. I hope that you'll be able to spend some time with Solzhenitsyn, and I hope that you heard in his speech that was given in 1970 a lot of commentary that we need to hear today in 2024. Thanks for listening. This is John Hodges with the Center for Western Studies. Drop me an email if you'd like to comment at director@centerws.com, and we will be back to see you next week. Thanks for listening.